Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Tuesday, April 9th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm speaking today with diplomatic correspondent Laser Berman. Hey, Laser.
Good morning.
Good morning. It is day 186 of the war. Earlier this morning, Hamas said that Israel's proposal for a truce and hostage deal does not necessarily meet the demands of its factions. Meanwhile, relatives of several American hostages will meet today with U.S. VP Kamala Harris after meeting yesterday with National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Israel's Defense Minister Yoav Gallant and U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke Monday about the continuing issue of humanitarian assistance delivery to Gaza, as the U.S. has said that last weekend's number of trucks bringing aid from Israel's Ashdod port and some other points was a good start, but it is certainly not the end of that story. We're going to talk about all of that in today's podcast. But before we get started, I'm going to point out a new project from our reader support group, the Times of Israel community. It's a time when Israeli artists are finding it increasingly difficult to share their work around the world, and Times of Israel community is celebrating and supporting them with a new series of Israeli documentary films that can be streamed online. It's called DocuNation. It includes 8 award-winning Israeli documentary films and meeting their creators in live online discussions. All the funds from this project will go directly to those documentary filmmakers. You can learn more about it at timesofisrael.com/doc, timesofisrael.com/DOC. Okay, we're going to talk about all of our topics today after a quick break.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Okay, Laser. So hostage negotiations are very much at the top of our page right now. Yesterday, Monday, things seemed hopeful, but it is clear from the Israelis and Hamas and what we're hearing that the path ahead is certainly not straight. What are you hearing and seeing and discerning from all of this?
So in general, I think Israeli officials are in private much more circumspect or less openly optimistic than we've heard. We've heard the Qataris especially give these optimistic readings. Now, they have an interest in doing so. I think there's a lot of frustration, certainly from Israel, but it seems like from the U.S. as well, about the effectiveness of Qatari mediation. It seems like they are not leaning or pressuring Hamas enough. And much of Qatar's claim to be immune from criticism over hosting Hamas is the fact that they're able to pressure Hamas because they host political leaders. And if they're not able to really pressure them, then should Qatar be off the hook? So that's why we have an optimistic reading from Qatar. Israeli officials say, listen, we're still a long, long way to go. Not necessarily in terms of time, but in terms of the sides coming together. What makes people kind of more optimistic, if you want to call it right now, is the fact that the U.S. is really throwing its weight behind it now. The U.S. is leaning into these. They're pressuring Qatar and Egypt to in turn pressure Hamas. And there is a number of reasons why the U.S. is doing this. One, they, in my reading, the Biden administration wants to see this thing wrapped up. It wants to see the hostages out. It wants to move beyond it. Does not want to, it really doesn't talk much about the military defeat of Hamas anymore. And it wants to see, a post-Hamas future that's not brought about by military operations. And let's not forget, if we have a ceasefire, let's say 6 weeks or maybe more, the idea that Israel would then pick up a military operation in the summer at the height of the campaign season, I think is not something that the Biden administration wants to see. So they're really leaning into it right now. We've seen very negative statements yesterday from Hamas officials, but I would just caution that these are not the decision makers. These are more spokespeople whose job it is, and not necessarily to speak the truth, even, you know, in the rather low standard of spokespeople anyway. These are Hamas spokespeople. So, you know, their job is to serve, you know, whatever propaganda interest they need to. And they keep saying that Israel's position doesn't even come close to the demands of the resistance, which are things that Israel can't accept. They can't accept an end to the war, and they can't accept a full pullout. But it seems like Israel is really showing a lot of flexibility on this Hamas demand to allow unfettered movement to the north. So it might not be totally unregulated, but it seems like there'll be much more movement to the north, if indeed there's a deal, than Israel would have liked a couple days ago.
Okay, so on the other hand, Israel withdrew troops, much of its troops, from parts of Gaza, and that was at the earlier part of this week. And then we also have Prime Minister Netanyahu saying, we have this a statement from last night, that there's a date to enter Rafah. He makes this very clear. So what does that mean in diplomatic terms? Are these statements in order to push other things along? Is this what it actually is? Give us a little bit of a sense of how you read this so that we can understand it better.
Yeah, so let's separate, even though we don't, it's not necessarily two totally separate issues, but let's start by separating the Khan Yunis troop deployment and the Rafah operation. Khan Yunis was the second major stage of the ground invasion. It came after the November ceasefire that got over 100 hostages out, and it featured one very high-quality IDF division. I don't just say that because I was in it, but Division 98 Paratrooper Special Forces with two tank brigades kind of latched on for this operation. That operation has been going on since early December, a very important operation. This is the first time that Hamas's Khan Yunis brigade has ever had combat friction with the IDF. And it was a complex operation, but after a certain point, operationally, if IDF troops are sitting there, they become kind of targets. And we've seen in the last week and a half, there were some incidents in which IDF soldiers were killed. So if indeed they've done what they came in to do, at least in smashing the Khan Yunis brigade, then there's a reason to pull them out, independent of anything else. Now, there are people who say that this is a sign to America. This is meant to bring the hostage talks along. Those type of things, haven't been able to confirm that, but there are certainly those ideas out there. The second issue, and this is more important, is the Rafah operation. We've talked about this several times. Manny's talked about it, Jacob as well. The last unconquered city is Rafah. It's a city that sits on the Egypt-Gaza border. It's important because of it sits on the border. That's where the vast majority of the weapons have come through. You have the Philadelphia route. And there's another brigade, four battalions, not the best battalions, and a lot of Hamas fighters who have fled south. If Israel would not conquer it, that would be the nucleus from which Hamas would retake the Gaza Strip after Israel pulls out. Israel has said consistently, both military and political leaders, that there's no way that Israel is not going to retake Rafah. Initially, the Biden administration said, you can't do it unless you evacuate the 1.5 million civilians, probably more than that, that are there. And more recently, Biden has said that it's a red line and we're against any major land operation. There was that video conference last week between Jake Sullivan and on the Israeli side, Dermer and Anegbi, that did not go well. It seems like the Americans were not very impressed with the evacuation plans that Israel presented. So this continues to be an issue where there is not agreement. But today, Netanyahu released a video statement that there is a date for Rafah operation. Who knows what that means? That could change, you know, but it's definitely a signal. Let's not forget it could be a signal about to Hamas to try to apply more pressure, the only lever that Israel really has on the hostage talks. So we don't know, you know, we got to keep all these things in mind. We don't know what will happen with that Rafah operation, but what we do know is that Israel leaders have been consistent that it'll happen. There's also been something interesting where the defense ministry has put out a mikhraz, what's that in English? A tender. There we go. For 40,000 tents, which means that they are really, preparing for a massive evacuation from the south. You obviously need more than 40,000 tents, but you see that there are starting to be some action on the ground for this mass evacuation if and when it happens.
Okay, so then we're just going to sort of watch this play out in a sense because we don't necessarily know where it's going to go at this point. That's the bottom line here in terms of Rafah. We don't necessarily know what will be the end result here. Is there any possibility that Israel would not go in? Do you ever see that happening?
I mean, here's why I don't think that's a possibility. Netanyahu's standing is not good right now. He, at some point, has to face the fact that he was prime minister during the October 7th attacks. The only way he could really credibly make a case for staying in power, which I'm sure he'd like to do, it's Netanyahu, is the fact that he was able to navigate the country through this very complex diplomatic and military reality. But if he doesn't go into Rafah, after he has promised that he would, and he explained that there's no victory without doing it, then how could he not? The caveat there is, I think it certainly won't be the same set of, I know it won't be the same type of massive operation we saw in Gaza City. That was at the beginning of the war. We didn't have the same type of intelligence. We didn't have the same type of confidence. Now we have much more intelligence. We know how to fight in a much more targeted fashion. That's why Khan Yunis looked very different than Gaza City. So it will, in its very nature, be more limited. It can't be too limited. The U.S. wants these like special forces operations. That's not the type of operation it is. It's not an operation to kill certain personnel, even though it's part of it. This is a unit-on-unit fight. It's meant to smash a military unit apart, which has to look a certain way. It needs to be combined arms. It needs infantry, tanks, certainly engineers, also air power, artillery. And it's not going to be this tiny operation. And I just want to focus listeners' attention on something. The last time we did a small operation in Rafah was that operation where we successfully extracted two hostages. Special forces operation. Since it was such a small force, when they were discovered in the exfiltration, when they were extracting them, they came under fire, and Israel needed to use a massive amount of air power to rescue the force since the initial force was so small. So just because it's a smaller force doesn't mean it's going to be less destructive. You have to have a certain amount of force to go in, secure the area, and then you can be more targeted. So I think these dreams about that in Washington that this is going to be some sort of targeted, you know, high-profile boutique special force operation absolutely is not in line with military reality at all.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that, Laser. We're going to take a quick break. When we're back, we will talk about aid, humanitarian aid into Gaza, which has really been an issue, obviously, that has been sticking in great parts since last week.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their like blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so Laser, you've got a big piece about this in which you write about the fact that aid really has been this straw that has pushed Israel's foreign allies to the limits. Obviously, we're talking also about the World Central Kitchen convoy that was bombed last week in which 7 aid workers were killed. There's been a lot of fallout from that. And then Israel came forward finally over the weekend and pushed these humanitarian aid trucks through into Gaza, which the U.S. is calling a good start. You have a number of articles about this issue and obviously about the diplomatic, you know, results of the humanitarian aid issue. Tell us, talk us through that article, talk us through that analysis.
Yeah, what frustrates me here is that the aid issue is distinct from other issues that have upset Israel's Western allies. There's the issue of statements from far-right ministers. Okay, you know, they don't like it. I'm sure they've made a much bigger deal of it. There's a reason why Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir are not really decision makers on the way the war goes. Okay, that's one. Number two is the civilian casualties. And, you know, we always get blamed for it no matter what. Certainly you compare it to what the forces of some of these countries did. I think we're in good hands there. And by any legal standard, that blame should fall on Hamas. It's not falling on Hamas enough. There's only so much we can do if we want to actually win the fight. And we want to do it in a reasonably quickly fashion. And we're not going to sacrifice all of our soldiers in order to save enemy civilians. So there's a legal and moral dispute there. But I think it's certainly reasonable and is in line with the desire of the Israeli public that we don't sacrifice large numbers of Israeli troops in order to protect Gazan civilians from being collateral damage. Although IDF troops have certainly died because of we're being careful. The one where we could have really avoided a lot of criticism is this humanitarian aid thing. From the beginning, forget Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, who's not far right and he's not even Bibi, said, I think it was 2 days after October 7th, so on October 9th, he said there's a complete siege, no fuel, water, food is going in. And then 2 weeks later, you know, we start having shipments of food in and fuel starts going in as well. Now, how could Israel not know this is going to happen? Do they really think that the world is going to stand by as people start to starve? Now, Hamas has some part of it. Obviously, they know they can use starvation and all this stuff as a tool, and they certainly are. But Israel has to see that. And what we've seen is that every time a government official, including Netanyahu, says, this won't happen, we're never going to open Kerem Shalom because we're going to disconnect Israel from Gaza. Of course, Kerem Shalom is open now, and now Kogat, the IDF unit which is responsible for the civil aid into the Gaza Strip, brags about how many trucks are going through Kerem Shalom every day. They've said, we're not going to use the Ashdod port. Well, we just said we're going to start using the Ashdod port. We said we're not going to open crossings in the north. Well, we opened the one, I think it's 96, that's the gate that they opened there, and now the one next to Erez is supposed to be open this week as well, 23. Jordan has said, let us send more from the Allenby crossing. We've said no, and now we are opening up there as well. There's no initiative on Israel's part. It seems like we don't want it to happen, and we're being pushed by our allies. In the end, we're doing it anyway. So why not show that we are getting ahead of this? There will be some small political price, and Ben-Gvir and Smotrich will get mad. Fine. But if the goal is to win this war and to break Hamas and get the hostages out, we need to do this. There's also a moral side to it, of course, but let's just think about the interest that we have here. We should be initiating. We should be building that pier for that water, for that maritime route. We should be talking to countries and aid agencies every day and figuring out how they can get more into the Gaza Strip and how it can be safe. We should see these as our strategic partners. Right? And we should be showing that we are always pushing forward. In 2014, Israel built a field hospital on the border between Gaza and Israel. It's an Israeli field hospital. Now, Hamas prevented people from going and no one really showed up. But we should do that as well. Let's build a couple more field hospitals. Really no cost on our part. And we get a lot of credit. And no one would be able to say that we are against aid because there's a reasonable, I don't think it's actually true, but we're kind of building the case for them.
So question, is it because we are just, Israelis are always just putting the fires out? Is it just because we're not thinking ahead? Is there some kind of diplomatic thinking here? Did Netanyahu not think that his allies would get angry about this? Explain it. Why do you think we are so behind the eight ball on this?
It's probably a combination where we've not shown initiative in a number of strategic areas, including the strategic messaging, right? The public diplomacy aspect of it, I think, is also is not especially well run. I think primarily, like a lot of decisions from every government, including the U.S., is domestic politics and not angering the right flank in this case. But also, I think, yeah, there has not, because they're so focused on, look what was done to us, and rightfully so, and now we're justified in this war 100%, But we have to understand that there are realities here. We might not like them. It might be unfair because, you know, Hamas is doing terrible things, getting in the way of aid. But listen, this is our responsibility, and this is also our interest. And a final thing, which I have not been able to square. Throughout the war, Israel has said that that there is no, Israel is not limiting the amount of aid going in, right? There's no Israeli limits. The problem is on the other side. I'm sure there is a problem on the other side. But we have seen this week that Israel has changed its own policies, and now there is a lot more aid going into the Gaza Strip, which seems to, which there's only two possible conclusions there, that indeed Israeli policies did limit aid in effect, or that all of these policies are actually having no effect because it's not going to change what was going in anyway. I've asked Kogat every day. They have not given any satisfactory answers when they do give answers, but I think this is another, we can't spokespeople our way out of this. We have to say we understand we are going to flood the Gaza Strip with aid. There should be a general, like on the Gal Hirsch type of role, like an aid czar that is in charge of this national effort, put money, put back behind it. And I think we will see much more latitude among our partners. And then when mistakes like the WCK strike happen, and that was a much more complex incident than initially we were blamed for, but it's still our fault, we'll have a much more leeway, and it won't be, you know, part of this bigger problem. So I think a lot of thinking needs to be done there. Hopefully we've moved beyond the you know, this kind of reactive thinking, but I still don't see any Israeli initiatives that are getting ahead of the eight ball. We're still just saying yes to demands from our partners.
Okay. Remains to be seen, I guess. All right. Laser, thank you very much for being with me on today's Daily Briefing. It's been good to see you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks. And thank you for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Stay tuned. We'll be back again tomorrow. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. If you have comments about this or any other episodes, always feel free to drop us an email, podcast@timesofisrael.com. And always, of course, feel free to recommend us. Until next time, take care. Have yourselves a good day.